my experience with reading Charles Mills is always like a series of very deep ambivalences that I don't actually feel, if I'm honest, that he resolves or feels the need to resolve. Because I think part of his relationship to political philosophy is strategic.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like a lot of this critique, I mean, this is, so I admire Charles Mills quite a bit. And so, like, I say this as, like, having, like, he's somebody that I have genuinely, like, wrestled with in, like, thinking through problems of race and class and, like, universalism and particularism and these various debates that we have. So, like, I think that this comes from a place of, like, wondering at what register his arguments hold. And I think that one register is anthropological. And I think that that's obvious. Like the first 60 pages of The Racial Contract are like, just like, look at what is going on. And I think that given the state of the debate in the 90s, that was important and now seems kind of rote. You know, like, we know this.
Yeah, I was having that thought
critiques,
too,
And the critiques of liberalism that follow that or are compatible with that, like, especially like Carol Pateman's and what he kind of models this thing on, these are like all, like, it's all like a very important intervention, but like once it's taken for granted, I feel like the philosophical ambivalences are, as I'm just not sure what level of analysis he wants me to be on, because I think it's very possible to say, yes, you're right, but we can fix social contract theory to accommodate these concerns. And some of his later work suggests that that's how he sees it too. In which case the philosophical critique is more like, pay attention to this and have it inform the way you think the apparatus works. But then there's also the suggestion that like ideal theory is ideology, you know, or like the way that, like, there's the ideology critique part of it. And I think that suggests more of an immanent critique. But then I'm not sure what to do with that if it's a critique and rescue. So am I making, like, I just feel are things I just genuinely don't totally know where to put him.
Yeah, this is really great. There's like a really, he himself draws, I think, correctly the like helpful illustrative contrast between himself and Pateman, right? On whose sexual contract this book is modeled. When he says, there's he quotes Pateman, it's somewhat early on, like maybe in the first 20 pages of the book, where she says things like, yeah, contract at all necessarily implies domination, coercion, exploitation. And he's like, I don't know about all that. I'm not sure. That seems kind of contingent to me, that, you know, the sort of, you know, standard liberal ideal theory articulations of there being freedom and equality amongst all, isn't this tarred and marred by the legacy of global white supremacy as an ascendant and fully determinative system, global system for the past 700 years? He's like, yeah, absolutely. That's what this whole book is about. I'm trying to show you that tacit agreement amongst whites to degrade and, you know, reduce to mere means and not treat as human all non-whites underwrites all of the sort of lovely discourse about equality and freedom that we're so familiar with from the tradition. But that seems contingent to me, he says, right? Like, I think that these are still, I mean, one way of asking the question would be like, you know, what is wrong with these ideals? And he doesn't seem to think that there is, or at least here he doesn't give us any reason to think, is there a problem with the idea of freedom and equality for all? And you know what? I don't know. I'm kind of, I'm sympathetic to this. Like, I'm not sure what the problem is with this idea of freedom and equality amongst all. And I mean, you might say here that there's like a kind of choice or decision that one could make, because I'm not sure that this is empirically decidable, right? Whether, I don't know if there's any kind of like empirical evidence that one could marshal either for or against the claim that, like, okay, given that, like, yeah, everyone agrees now, especially now, like, I like your point, Lillian, about like contextualizing it. Like, it's not the 90s anymore, right? Most of us these days are like, yeah, well, we're not really living up to the old ideals of, like, you know, beautiful liberal egalitarianism, right? Like, we now know that the discourse has moved forward sufficiently for us to mostly all be on the same page. They're like, yeah, racism is still kind of a problemo. Yeah, but you know, do we have any reason empirically or theoretically to say, therefore jettison the ideal? Or, on the other hand, retain the ideal and recognize its inadequacy or insufficiency? He goes the latter route, which to some seems optimistic, and to some seems naive. And I don't know. I kind of like the optimistic reading of it, but maybe that's my own naivete.
I think it's strategic based on things that he has said late in his career, where, you know, he started out as a Marxist. I believe we have access to what, and you'd know better than me the name of it. It's something Caribbean. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. Where it's like race, class, and something. Yeah. So it's about it's his early Caribbean text anyway. And so, yeah, so sometimes people would ask him, you know, why'd you leave the Marxism behind? And he's actually strikingly honest. You know, he's like, to get in the door, I realized that the state of play was you needed to start speaking, you know, in the ideological universe of liberalism. Yeah. I remember I was in grad school and I saw him give a talk and he said that. And I was shook. I didn't think you were allowed to say something like that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What in the world? Why are you admitting that this is strategic?
Right.
Which isn't to say that he doesn't actually believe in these liberal principles.
Yeah.
But I think he's self-consciously being strategic. So there is an optimism there. But I also think that there's a type of strategy there of him gauging the field of play.
Yeah, he wrote a dissertation on analytical Marxism. And credit to him for going into that kind of analytic political philosophy world and doing exactly the thing. You know, the other day I was complaining on Twitter about how, like, too much analytic political philosophy deals with, like, hypotheticals instead of history. He goes right in and is like, this is all, you guys are obsessed with hypotheticals, like social contract hypotheticals. Let me tell you about the actual, like, origin story and genesis of, like, white polities in the state. So credit to him for going in and, I don't know, for, like, going into the belly of the beast and, like, really undermining some of, I think, like, the most counterproductive, like, trends in that. But more importantly, I just wanted to say something before we get too far away from it, if you guys don't mind, that he puts, it seems to me there's all kinds of, like, challenges to his recovery of the social contract tradition, like, in his own work. Like, that's why at the end it's almost kind of surprising that he thinks that it's reformable or recoverable, because one of the main points that he makes, and he goes back and looks at Hobbes compared to Rousseau, right? He says, look what happens in the social contract tradition, right? For Hobbes, the individual doesn't change much when they leave the state of nature and they go into civil society, right? When they're pulled into the body politic.
Yeah.
All they do is that they just have to constrain their behavior a little bit.
Rein it in a little bit.
the behavior has to be constrained. I mean, it has to be constrained, and it's going to be constrained by fear. I mean, he doesn't really believe in the self-constraint in that way. But yeah, there's just a bit of constraint that comes into the picture. By the time you get to Rousseau, it's a really different picture. And he's very interested in the Rousseauian picture because for Rousseau, it's like, no, the movement from the state of nature into civil society is a complete subjective metamorphosis, right? Mm-hmm. You learn morality. You learn how to privilege right over force, how to differentiate between might and right, and how to privilege, like, right over force. Like, it's a real major transformation. He's obsessed with education, all these things, right? Like, the formation, right, of the person is a crucial part of what the social contract looks like for Rousseau. And then he says, the idea of the racial contract, as I'm trying to stipulate it, functions similarly. Like, I do believe that for the construction and the erection of the white body, of the white polity, a major metamorphosis, a kind of subjective metamorphosis takes place. That's what part of what the racial contract produces. It produces a totally changed subject, whether you're in a settler colony or even if you're in Europe and, you know, and your polity is engaged in that imperialism. It changes you in, like, fundamental ways, in ways that support and reproduce white supremacy. So what I'm getting to is the reason why I think he poses challenges that I'm not sure he's telling me how they're going to be overcome is, like, there's no, like, juridical or a formal institutional, like, solution to any of that. I mean, it almost makes you start thinking something like Foucault's, like, care of the self or practices of the self or some kind of subjective transformation, right? Where we, like, desubjectivate the way we've been shaped by white polities. And I hate, it's an annoying word, but bear with me. We desubjectivate the way our subjectivity, right? And then we reconstitute ourselves as subjects who are not signatories to the racial contract, who are not tacitly okay with white supremacy, who, yeah, that seems to require a lot more than what you're going to get out of a kind of liberal contractarian. Like, I don't see any resources for that kind of subjective, almost spiritual, moral transformation in the contractarian liberal tradition. Hey, thanks so much for listening. This was just a small sample of the full episode. To listen to it and to access other premium content we're putting out, including all of our locked episodes and bonus videos, please subscribe to us on Patreon at patreon.com/leftofphilosophy. See you next time.